A big thank you to our sponsors because they make this show possible, and I hope that you support them the way they support us. Progress Software is the creator of the most comprehensive developer toolkit for building modern apps on the market today, Telerik DevCraft. With more than 1,100 Telerik.NET and Kendo UI JavaScript components and controls, you can easily build modern, high-performance web, mobile, and desktop apps, as well as chatbots. The toolset also includes reporting solutions, automated testing, and productivity tools, and comes with a range of support options. New this year is a free online training program for all license holders. With this, alongside thousands of demos and source code available, comprehensive documentation, and a full assortment of Visual Studio templates, you'll be up and running with the Progress Telerik and Kendo UI controls in no time. Download a free 30-day trial today at Telerik.com/Hanselman. That's Telerik.com/Hanselman. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Dr. Hannah O. Descher. She's a PhD in cognitive neuroscience and a data scientist working at Microsoft on something that was just so exciting. I wanted to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm doing well. Hi, Scott. Nice to meet you. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah, this is going to be great. So I learned recently about this idea of PlayFab, PlayFab. It's a game backend as a service.
Mm-hmm.
So this is amazing. Like if I make a game, I know I have to like set up, like sign in, and maybe I can do a top 10 leaderboard. But you're telling me I'm going to spend a lot of time like making the back end when I really just want to make the game.
Right. Yeah. So PlayFab provides a complete cloud-based backend as a service for games. So like, if you think like traditionally how games were used to sold and operate, you know, like you would just go to a store and buy like a game, and that the content never changed, and you know, like you were kind of like playing a stationary game that over and over again, right? But now more and more games are actually being operated as services, and you can't even consider games as an ongoing conversation with customers. So, for example, games can launch live events and send out push notifications or even react to certain player actions in real time. And this is not uncommon, right? You download mobile games, and most games nowadays do these things. And on the other end of the spectrum, sometimes games can crash, which used to be the end of the game lifecycle. But now they can actually quickly roll back without really affecting much of their player base.
And we're getting updates constantly. Like on my phone, I might see a game update once a month or even once a week.
Yeah. And, you know, like it's the backend services that actually are not visible. But all of these like try to operate your game actually requires extensive backend infrastructure such as, you know, CRM, marketing automation, content automation, commerce system, customer support, big data analytics, and localization tools, along with all the other in-game features such as leaderboards and matchmaking. And, you know, to effectively operate a game, it's not just about building these tools independently, but all of these tools need to talk to each other.
That seems like it's like as a game developer, the least interesting part of it, but it's also going to be like the base of this pyramid or the underneath of a giant iceberg. Like I'll spend 20% on the game, but I'm really going to need a lot of work if I want to succeed. And ideally, the customer will never see it. They'll just have a great experience with a back end that they'll never know exists.
Right. Yeah. So PlayFab operates these like backend services specialized for games, offering, you know, extensive cloud-based tools and covering all the things that I mentioned just now, like all platforms like PC, mobile, Xbox, PlayStation, or Nintendo, you name it. And it is a very cost-effective way to start launching and operating your games. And, you know, we enable developers so that they can focus on making their games fun rather than focusing on stressing out about building their backend infrastructure.
So how much do you think that most game developers are spending on the front end versus the back end these days?
Well, I don't have the exact answer, but, you know, typically game developers used to spend like years in making games, and upon release, their job was considered done. But nowadays, we see some of our customers spending maybe as little as 8 weeks building the game, and then many years of fixing, improving, and operating their game. So many successful games today spend as much time and effort operating their live game as they did to bring it to the market.
Interesting. And they have to keep that game up and keep it running 24/7. They have to babysit the game and make sure that it's like there's DevOps now for games.
Right. So yes, a lot of mobile developers, especially the indie studios, like we see them like launching the very MVP and lean version of the games first, and then sort of like improving as their customer base increases and, you know, getting their feedback and, you know, just continuously operating and improving and make sure that they're actually kind of like going more to a more like full-fledged product than sort of like staying at that MVP state.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a PhD in cognitive neuroscience. Is that like how the brain works?
Yeah. So I actually spent about 10 years sort of like studying how people operate, like kind of ranging from, you know, vision, kind of looking into how people perceive motion and depth, like using like a very sort of like initial version of VR goggles. Mm. And then my PhD work was more related to sort of like how do people make decisions? How do people learn from the environment? So I actually sort of like studied how people do reinforcement learning, not the machines do reinforcement learning, you know?
Hmm. Now, is reinforcement learning, that's something certainly where I can go and learn a topic and I can understand what the best way to teach something is, but can that be then applied to like making an online game better and making someone happier when they're doing something that isn't necessarily learning?
Well, it's sort of like an kind of like optimal, like you could certainly use it to optimize your machine, basically. So the whole theory behind reinforcement learning is that like the information in our environment is kind of probabilistic, meaning that we don't necessarily get a very stationary conclusions based on the decision that we make every day. Even like imagine you're sort of like driving your car, trying to merge into a very busy, you know, highway, and you actually have to have a lot of information to actually merge without crashing into another car. And humans do this like really fast and fairly easily if you're like a pretty advanced driver. And machines actually tend to fail a lot in given the same situation. So it's certainly sort of like interesting kind of like how people sort of like learn through experience, optimize their decision-making skills, and then apply it in a real world situation.
Hmm. So reinforcement learning is also how people learn, but it's also how computers learn, like in the machine learning context.
Oh, yeah.
You have to run an agent through a process, and then hopefully they'll change their state based on some reward that they're given by the scenario.
Right, yeah. So the reward is like the very sort of like a signal that actually makes machines to learn and optimize their skills, or sort of like value which information is more important in driving a better decisions over the other, I guess.
Now, if we apply that to a game or to a piece of software, is that enabling the user then to achieve their goal more, have more fun while they're doing it? They open their, you know, whatever it is, their loot box or their next achievement in the game, and then the cycle continues.
Yeah, certainly. It's sort of like you can actually kind of use that algorithm to sort of like make the games more fun and make, you know, the experience more engaging for users.
So if someone's listening to this show and maybe they've thought about making a game, or in the past they've already made a game and put one out there, they might be thinking, wow, this is an awful lot of science and PhDs I just want to make a fun game. Mm-hmm. But this is proven to make games better, right? Like you are making games more fun and making people stick around and play them longer when you think about science in this way.
Right. The whole goal of data scientists, especially on gaming, is to make games more fun, you know, with the goal of improving acquisition, engagement, and retention of your player base. A lot of people think that data science is like, you know, just kind of collecting and tracking some well-known metrics such as, you know, number of new installs, monthly, daily active users, mm-hmm. player retention, in-game revenue, or even crash rates that can actually help developers to track performance of their games. But it's not really limited to that. I mean, if you have a really good set of data scientists, you can do way more, you know, interesting things with the resources.
That's a really good point. So you are a data science with a particular background. Yours is in cognitive neuroscience. You're not just going to sit there and say, oh, look, we have a this many percent retention rate. If we change this, we'll retain more.
Right.
You can go far beyond that and understand why people do what they do and push them forward in the game.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, there are so many different reasons people play games. I mean, some people seek new experience, some people play to socialize with others, and some people just simply play to kill time. And, you know, modern games, like the player base is also kind of like coming from many different parts of the world. And they may come from very diverse cultural backgrounds. And they may also be comprised of wide range of age groups. And as you can imagine, like player behavior differs widely across these groups. And you can certainly use data science to identify like these different player groups, characterize how different or similar they are in their activity patterns, and detect which part of the game players are most engaged, or even at which point players often struggle and likely decide to quit playing the games. And all of these is just to sort of like improving the quality of the product, as well as sort of like games from the player side, making gameplay experience more fun and engaging.
Hmm. So when we think about how a person engages with a game, you're sending whatever telemetry you as the game developer chooses to mm-hmm. the back end. In this case, it might be PlayFab. So it could be, you know, user entered a new area, user did something in their inventory. It's really up to you as the game developer to decide what you want to capture in order to make the decision about what later will be chewed up as data in the data science side.
Right. So, I mean, like game developers that know their games the best, right? So mm-hmm. data scientists can certainly work with developers to actually, let's say like, okay, these are the good telemetry events that you need to implement in the game to measure, you know, like where players are most engaged or where they're failing or whether the tutorial is very helpful or not, you know, things like that. And then we can work with the developers to tune their games with the optimal parameters to provide more tailored experience for this diverse player groups or even for an individual player.
Mm. So when this gets pulled into the PlayFab backend, the game backend as a service, then we as the DevOps people in the game can chew that data, look at that data, and then apply whatever we want to confirm or deny our assumptions about how people move around the game?
That's our goal. So mm-hmm. we are still at an early stage, and we are sort of like trying to help developers to make these telemetry decisions better, help them to better interpret their data. And we can also try to optimize our backend system to easily push out different contents, different store offerings, or even different gameplay experience based on what we found in the data.
I see. And because the game front end can be changed and the back end is always being improved, we might be able to discover things farther along in the process that may not exist today.
Right. And then, you know, game developers can make changes to their games, update their contents, and which we refer to as live ops. And it's like providing customized experience for each player so that they can continue to engage.
Hmm. The idea of real time is really interesting because we're not just chewing on data from like last week and all the sessions last week. You can literally say, you know, the people in India are waking up right now and they're starting to enter the game. So now because of the time of day, you know, we're really hot in this time zone and those people are coming in. And they, like you said before, they might be treating the game differently than someone in another country and we can give them a better experience.
Yeah. I mean, for example, I mean, since it's October, let's imagine that you are trying to run a Halloween event, right? Like introducing special themes and items in the game. And you see so many games do this nowadays, right? Mm-hmm. And so it might be a really good idea to launch the event only in the countries that celebrate Halloween, like the US. And you can also try to widely announce the events, and you might want to send out a push or email notification to players in these countries. And you can even offer like special Halloween discounts only to the group of your most, you know, royal players who's been active in your game for a long period of time or have spent a large amount of money in your game. And then to go one step further, to make things more interesting, you can also set some limited time achievements. So for example, collecting a rare set of items to unlock a hidden level or special rewards, or have a real-time leaderboards that show progress amongst a group of friends.
Hmm. I never even thought, it's such an obvious thing to say now that you've said it, but the idea that I would not want to do a worldwide Halloween push if a country doesn't celebrate it or doesn't even care.
Right. It's not going to be relevant for their experience, right? Like, you might want to target different type of events for the countries that are not in that group of countries, you know?
I see. So then we're segmenting our different player groups. They're all getting a different experience. And this is part of that concept that you refer to called live ops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's code for all of this. Like, I noticed when I went up to GitHub that at the GitHub for PlayFab, there's a game, like a full game called Unicorn Battle that like has examples of how to do this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like Unicorn Battle is like sort of like our example game, kind of showing off our, you know, capabilities using our PlayFab backend. And you can do really interesting things. You can push out like a new store offerings to your specified segments in a real time, or change the content, you know, or even like update like player status just in real time, just using a few simple button clicks.
Mm-hmm. So there's in-game promotions that we talked about, and there's like, you know, cross promoting if someone did something and you want to let them know about something else that's going on, but also the obvious things like leaderboards, but messaging and DLC as well.
Right. So like live ops strategies is just a collection of strategies for games to continue to connect and develop deep relationships with players for the long haul. And all with the goal at improved acquisition, engagement, and retention. And we see all the time that an effective live ops strategy can make the difference between success and failure for a modern game. And, you know, sometimes it can even turn games into forever franchises.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. There are games that I have had for years that you would think would not be fresh anymore, but they are changing, they are growing, and they are different. So I keep coming back to them.
Yeah. So it's like a new challenge, new content update, and, you know, new events. Those are all sort of like very helpful in acquiring new players, and as well as like providing new content and interesting challenges to existing players.
Mm-hmm. Today's episode was sponsored by AcuSoft. Since 1991, AcuSoft has offered a robust portfolio of content processing and conversion solutions built for developers by developers. The offerings include high-performance document capture, forms processing, viewing, search, compression, conversion, barcode recognition, OCR, ICR, and MICR. You can visit acusoft.com/Hanselminutes. To try out the solutions for yourself. The first 40 people to visit the site and register for a demo will get a free AcuSoft t-shirt. That's AcuSoft, acusoft.com/Hanselminutes. Now, all of this, from my perspective as the consumer, is I want to be happy and enjoy myself. And then from the point of view of the game maker, they want their people to be happy, but they also want them to remain players. They want them to be satisfied. And I was reading your PhD thesis, and I saw a word I did not recognize called satisficing.
Right.
What is that? That's an awesome word. I know it's a portmanteau of something. What is satisficing?
It's a sort of like a made-up word, like proposed by Herbert Simon, who actually won a Nobel Prize in economics back in 1980s or something. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like a merge of two different words, satisfied plus suffice. So people are like, in the real world, like, it's actually really, really difficult to make an optimal decision. And I'm not even sure if there's such thing as optimal decision, given the sort of like unknown uncertainties and probabilities of the information. So it's sort of like a word that's used to describe how people make decisions based on heuristics. So people tend to make decisions that's kind of good enough or suffice to satisfy their threshold.
Okay, so they're not necessarily making optimal decisions, but they are making reasonable decisions that meet a certain bar or level of quality. They
exactly.
suffice as decisions.
Right. Yes. And that's what enables sort of like a quick decision, you know? Like if you walk into a grocery store and you're trying to pick up a peanut butter, there are so many different peanut butter brands and, you know, like they are positioned differently, their labels are different. And how do you know whether you actually pick the optimal peanut butter for yourself?
Yeah, okay. So I'm applying this to games. I know that very often I'll be running through a dungeon and I'll get a new sword or a new shield and I'll go, oh, I don't have enough information to decide if this is the right one or the best one. I just want the best one. And then
right.
I'm forced to make some what I feel is suboptimal decision. And then I have to run forward with some sword made of paper. I'm not sure if it's the right one.
Yeah, but interesting thing is, like, humans are actually extremely good at making this type of heuristic decisions that are close to optimal, which is kind of surprising.
Interesting. So how is this different from making a decision based on your gut?
It's a very similar idea, actually. So people often describe it just as a gut decision-making as well. So when I was doing my PhD, I was also looking into brain activities involved in this type of decisions versus something that was actually overlearned and on and sort of like making optimal decisions. And, you know, like this type of heuristic decision-making actually takes very little time and also involves less of prefrontal cortex, which is known to be involved in making more logical reasoning and sort of like more information-based decisions.
Okay, so if I'm making a gut decision or if I feel like my, you know, my chest rather than the front of my head is helping me make the decision, what part of the brain is lit up or is it even being used to make those decisions?
So it's the part of the brain that I found was called striatum. It's actually heavily involved in reinforcement learning as well. So if you're sort of like learning through experience, and then you're kind of like making the choice without really kind of logically going through what reasoning steps you're, that you're taking, then this part of the brain actually lights up pretty intensely. And this is also very heavily, like very closely connected to motor reactions as well. So it actually triggers faster motor response.
Interesting. That makes me feel like if I was playing a very twitchy game, then that would be the brain that would be involved in making those quick decisions where I don't even feel like I'm making a decision, but I probably am.
Right. Like first-person shooter game. It's like all about motor reactions, right? You're not actually kind of going, thinking through, like saying like, oh, I detected an enemy right there, and I'm going to use this machine to optimally kill that person.
Okay. So in the game, of course.
Right, in the game.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. So, but there are things that exist. There are theories and frameworks around like how people move through the world. And there's theories like rational choice theory that propose mm-hmm. that users have a certain preference and they can make an, you know, basically an educated decision.
Right.
How does sufficing relate to the theory that you can make decisions with appropriate information and have an opinion?
Well, I mean, our brain stores so much data mm-hmm. and we have abundance of memory from built from infancy to childhood to up until adulthood, right? Mm-hmm. So we have this abundance of information that actually pre-trains us to, you know, make decisions that are fairly rational mm-hmm. and we develop preference. And if you are actually sort of like making a very simple choices, like, I don't know, simple choice.
Cookies,
right. You have a clear preference. If you're kind of like given a choice between chocolate chip cookie versus potato chips, you probably have pretty good, you know, like preference to which one you like. Mm-hmm. So that's, to your standpoint, that's probably a rational choice to make. And that's fairly easy choice to make because you already have a clear preference. But if you are sort of like, if you actually joined, you know, a new workspace or like you got a new job, like people sort of like don't know how to act or for a couple of days, you know, like don't know how to interact well. Or when I first joined Microsoft, I was having so much trouble, you know, just kind of like adapting to using Outlook. You know, I didn't know how mm-hmm. to book a meeting room. And those things, you know, like I learned pretty fast, but like, you know, it's a steep learning curve.
It is. This is a little bit random, but there's a show, one of my favorite TV shows is called The Good Place. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever seen it before.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Okay. You know how Chidi on The Good Place has troubles with decisions? And uh-huh. there was an episode last week where he was trying to decide if he wanted a blueberry muffin or another kind of muffin.
Yes.
And he finally came up with it. I'm going to have a blueberry muffin. And then he learned that the farmers that made the blueberries were like oppressed. And he received way more information than he needed, and he no longer could make an optimal decision.
Right.
And he was choosing to make optimal decisions rather than trying to make satisfactory ones. Mm-hmm. And it ultimately kind of destroyed him. He was unable to make any decision at all.
Yeah, because we are constantly surrounded by uncertainties of the world. Like, there's no guarantee that, like, the today's blueberry muffin will guarantee the quality of tomorrow's blueberry muffin.
Yeah, and any cereal that you eat today will probably cause cancer in rats tomorrow.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. So, okay, so people are trying to evaluate like all the available information, both subconsciously and consciously, and they're using different parts of their brains to make decisions. And if we apply like what we know about how people move through life, mm-hmm. we can presume that they'll move similarly through the game. And I assume we can make even like A-B tests or test these theories as people move through our games to see if we offer them something, they'll be excited about it or they'll shun it.
Yeah, I mean, like that's the sort of like the critical thing about having LiveOps strategy. So like, mm-hmm. it's not just about like running the LiveOps events. It's more critical to assess the effect of the strategy after the event, you know? So you want to evaluate like what percentage of players actually engage, or like, was it effective in attracting new players? Did it bring back lapsed players, or was it helpful in growing revenue? All these questions are interesting, and it's sort of like a, you know, it's an iterative process of sort of like forming your optimal strategy in some sense.
Mm-hmm. And in your paper, in your thesis, you talk about decision making in small worlds, in large worlds, and in the real world. I assume a game is a small world.
Game is a small world depending on how developers choose to design it. So if it's Super Mario, for example, like you probably know the consequence of like hitting the brick or like, you know, getting like hit by the flower and stuff like that. But I mean, some developers actually choose to make their games somewhat probabilistic. So like the same game action does not really result in the same game reaction. And that is actually sort of like more of a large world scenario.
Oh, okay. So a massively multiplayer game, or a game that is persistent or lives forever with thousands or millions of people in it, is going to be in fact a large world and feel much different.
Yeah.
Interesting. So then how much time do you think people should put into understanding these things or running these experiments as they try to make their games successful?
I mean, for running experiments, there's certainly statistical theories that actually measures, you know, number of sample sizes, how long the experiment should run and stuff like that. But I mean, this is an iterative process. As long as the game's alive, then I mean, this is the data science should be involved all the time.
So you should always be having experiments and always be trying to learn more about how your players play your game and how they enjoy your game.
Right. Yeah. So it's just kind of like going back to the LiveOps theory that, like, you know, it's just about continuously improving your product so that it stays relevant.
Mm-hmm. And you said that this is just kind of getting started, that PlayFab is just kind of integrating itself into the Microsoft ecosystem. Is this something people can sign up for and learn about now? Are people are using this now today, correct?
Yes. I mean, we have thousands of developers who are already using PlayFab, and you can simply try it out at playfab.com by signing up. And it's free. It's free service until you reach 1,000 MAU. And yeah, so feel free to try it out. And you can
What is that word that you just said, 1,000 MAU?
So 1,000 monthly active player is sort of like our business model of saying, okay, your game has significant users, so maybe you might consider paying us.
I see. So that's MAU, MAU is what?
Monthly active users.
Monthly active users. Mm-hmm. So if I make a niche game, or I'm getting started testing my game or trying it out, it is free. And then at some point when I hit the limit, I should consider paying. And there's a free guide as well. It's like a whole document that is you can download, a PDF that explains what LiveOps is and how that strategy can help your game succeed.
Yes, it's on our website. It's called Guide to LiveOps. Yeah, and it's free to download. And if you're interested, you can check it out and see and learn about LiveOps event.
Mm-hmm. And this plugs into any engine, right? Like I'm a .NET developer, so I use Unity and I can make Xbox games or whatever. PlayFab works anywhere, basically on any engine.
Yeah, exactly.
So I can use it on a phone as well, and you have people doing that as well?
Yeah, you can change like game settings on your phone. We have a backend UI that actually enables you to just update the contents using any web browser. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's fairly easy to use.
Cool. So there's SDKs for every platform, and it's free until we get really big. And I can check it out at playfab.com?
Yeah. Everything's free when you first sign up. So yeah, please check out playfab.com and sign up and make a new account, and you can start plugging in your new game into PlayFab.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hannah O. Descher, for chatting with me today.
Thank you, Scott, for inviting me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.